They're light, they're flexible, and the good support, but the grip on the deck is incredible, even on ice.
An Alaskan wardrobe standard moves production offshore. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 5th of July. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, big waves and severe thunderstorms greet canoe racers on the Yukon River Quest.
I love it. I mean, this is my third time, and I just wish it was a bit closer to home. I'd be here every year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Preliminary necropsy results on the pregnant sea lion, which died at the Alaska Sea Life Center last month, show she had pancreatic cancer. Kiska was nearing the end of her pregnancy term when she died suddenly. Veterinary staff weren't able to save her pup either. Ian Dutton is CEO of the Alaska Sea Life Center. He says the animal likely had the disease before she became pregnant, but it's not unusual that the staff wouldn't have caught it.
We do a whole range of blood screens, just like anyone in any human equivalent pregnancy. But in this case, because we just have so little knowledge about the species and about their blood chemistry and so on, it's not unusual that we wouldn't pick up something like this until we have a chance to do the necropsy that we've done now. We don't have the same sort of level of medical understanding of these animals as we do of humans.
Dutton says the cancer was certainly a factor in Kiska's death, but more tests will determine whether there were other contributors. He says the test results may help staff at the Sea Life Center develop disease indicators that could make it easier to detect cancer earlier in the future. Extra tufts are as common in Alaska as the Stetson hat is in Texas. The brown fisherman's neoprene boots are the last rubber footwear made in the United States. But production of the boots is moving out of its plant, and officials in the city where extra tufts are made say the jobs are going overseas. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Acknowledging that extra tough boots are popular in Alaska is like telling someone, hey, that newfangled automobile might just catch on. The boots have been around for years, and they're everywhere, including at Sitka's Eliason Harbor. Paul Yannick owns the Sequoia, a 56-foot wooden fishing vessel. He says extra toughs are as important to fishing as anything else on board the boat.
They're light, they're flexible, and a good support. They're easy to get on and off. They grab your ankles, you know, they hold tight on your feet. But the grip on the deck is incredible, even on ice.
On board, a couple crew members are listening to an iPod and preparing bait before they go longlining for black cod. One of them is Mike McVeigh, who, yes, is wearing extra tufts, just as he has since he started fishing in Alaska 19 years ago.
I came up here from Texas, so I didn't know much about anything as far as what to wear. And traded in my cowboy boots for extra tufts, because that's the advice I was given, and they were right.
So news that extra tufts' parent company, Honeywell, plans to move production of the boot overseas came as a surprise to McVeigh, but he says the boots are so ingrained in Alaska culture that moving the manufacturing operation should not make a big difference to their popularity.
Yeah, as long as they're available, you know, if they're still readily available, then the news is not all bad.
Extra tufts were first made by the B.F. Goodrich Company in the 1950s, and in the 1970s, production moved to a plant on the Mississippi River in Rock Island, Illinois. Honeywell Corporation bought the brand in 2008, and the company confirms that it's moving extra tough manufacturing out of the Illinois plant by April at the earliest. KCAW requested a phone interview with Honeywell and sent questions by email. The company replied with a one-paragraph written statement that said moving extra tough production out of the Rock Island plant will, quote, build the company's manufacturing footprint. Most of our specific questions went unanswered, such as where the boots will now be made or how many U.S. jobs will be affected.
For us, it's 250 250 to 300 jobs. They didn't give us an exact number.
That is David Pauly, the mayor of Rock Island.
We were told that they're consolidating it. They have another plant in China that makes the same boot, and they're consolidating all their operations to that one plant.
Pauly says his office got wind of the company's plan about 2 or 3 months ago.
So we called them and asked them what was going on. They sent some representatives in town. We talked about it, asked if there was anything that we could do to keep the plant here, and the decision has already been made.
He says about 45 Honeywell employees will stay in Rock Island to work on products other than Extra Tufts. Back to Sitka. If Extra Tufts are most visible in the harbors, maybe the second biggest collection of the boots is at Murray Pacific. The large store deals in fishing gear and is one of Alaska's biggest Extra Tuft dealers.
Okay, so we'll start out here with the insulated. They just have a little insulation in them, and you still need to have a liner in the sole to keep your feet warm. So we saw.
That's Linda Board. She manages Murray Pacific. Hundreds of pairs of boots are lying on their sides in this aisle, oddly enough, like freshly caught fish at an open-air market.
At a given time, we probably have about 300 pair on hand, and we sell them all year round.
She heard the boots will be made overseas from the Extra Tuft sales rep who visits her 2 or 3 times a year. As a result, she is stocking up.
I have a huge order coming the 1st of July, just in case there's a time lag of them getting set up and a lead time to get them in. Because they've been so good coming out of Chicago, I can order them and I can have them here in 3 weeks. So I don't know whether that's going to be the case now.
It's really nice to have something made in America.
That's Gary Hayes, who manages Sitka's Work and Rugged Gear store.
Filson and Company, along with Pendleton, have been kind of our two big outerwear brands that have somewhat kept things domestic, along with some sock brands. But, yeah, it's going to change. I mean, they really, it's on every box, made in the USA.
And when that label goes away, Hayes says he has some questions. He presumes, for example, that by moving the manufacturing overseas, the company will save money. And he wonders if that savings will be passed along to retailers so that they, in turn, can pass it along to customers who might expect a lower price once they know that the boots aren't made in the United States anymore. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
This year's Yukon River Quest was long on aches and short on records, but many participants enjoyed it anyway. The 460-mile race goes from Whitehorse to Dawson City in the Yukon. Texans paddling a Voyager canoe beat out solo kayaker Carter Johnson for first place by only seconds as they sprinted for the finish line. It's the Texans' third win, and like many of the racers, they were sore after fighting big waves on Lake LaBarge, a slow river and ferocious thunderstorms. CBC's Dave Croft reports.
Come on, New Jersey!
The Voyager canoe team from Jersey and Britain's Channel Islands took third place overall. They had been vying for first, but Captain Rob Casson says muscle injuries slowed them down and almost forced them out about halfway through, but they decided to carry on. He's glad they did.
I love it. I mean, this is my third time, and I just wish it was a bit closer to home. I'd be here every year.
There were many stories of personal achievement. Ingrid Wilcox of Whitehorse finished her 10th race in the solo kayak class. A good-sized crowd met her at the finish line where she downplayed her achievement.
An hour ahead of last year.
An hour behind what he intended.
Solo kayaker Sean Corrigan of CarMax was 6th overall and the first Yukoner into Dawson City. He damaged a ligament in his left shoulder and spent the last 5 or 6 hours on the river in pain.
Just had a goal and I wasn't going to fail, so just pushed through.
There were 24 scratches in this year's race. Race Marshal Scott Puska says that may be the record. He thinks large waves on Lake LaBarge took a lot out of people early on.
It's a lot more vomiting and just sort of personal suffering that's making them drop out.
Puska says one paddler seemed to disappear in the last day of the race. A search and rescue operation was being prepared when the man arrived on his own just before 3 Sunday morning. CBC News, Dave Croft.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, exploring the meaning of wilderness in Southeast Alaska.
It is really kind of an interesting juxtaposition of these are areas meant to be untouched and untrammeled, but they do take some caretaking.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
A citizen group says local sales tax money should be used to pay for a North Douglas crossing. For years, the city and borough of Juneau's top transportation priority has been a second bridge linking the mainland to the island. City officials believe the best potential for future development is in the West Douglas area. Emergency access and congestion on the existing bridge are also concerns. Despite its best efforts, the city has never been able to secure state or federal funding for the project. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Rick Shattuck is with SAFE, Safety, Affordability, Future, Efficiency, an ad hoc group that wants to use Juneau's temporary 1% sales tax to pay for a North Douglas crossing. The tax expires in 2013, but Shattuck says extending it for 8 or 9 years would provide the $70 million necessary to get the project done.
North Douglas Crossing has been talked about for a long time. It is not going anywhere at this point in time unless we try and do something about it locally.
Shattuck says local engineers volunteered time to help SAFE with a conceptual design. It includes a 1.5-mile causeway with a 16-foot-high bridge at mid-channel, bike and pedestrian paths, and a pullout to access the Mendenhall Wetlands State Game Refuge.
The pedestrian path and bike path are just going to be a great recreational opportunities for people to, you know, go out and walk their dog in the evening, go out and walk in the wetlands, or, I mean, it could even enable people, frankly, to ride their bike tour from North Douglas to Valley and that type of thing. And the mid-crossing pullout, think of the pullout that's currently kind of across from the landfill there on Egan Drive, and we feel that this mid-crossing pullout is just one more asset that will, frankly, enhance access to the wetlands, whether that's for bird viewers, bird hunters, or people just going out for a walk.
In 2007, the Juneau Assembly identified a crossing at Vanderbilt Hill Road as the city's preferred alternative for the project. That was before the State Department of Transportation built an overpass on Egan Drive at Sunny Point, which the SAFE project would incorporate into the crossing. Shattuck says one of the benefits of putting it there is that it would connect to CBJ land on Douglas.
Most of the other routes that they've looked at on this project don't have that type of ease of coming on shore with some land to deal with it, and frankly are likely to have much more direct impact on the neighboring residents before they can even do anything getting on shore. I mean, we feel this project enables the crossing to be built with minimal impacts to the neighborhood.
Of course, the project still faces significant hurdles, not the least of which is concern over how it would affect the wetlands. About 6 years ago, the city did the early stages of an environmental impact statement. That EIS will have to be finished, and a lot of other work remains to be done before permitting could begin. Shattuck says the impact would be minimal.
This project impacts 12 acres of a 4,000-acre refuge. That's less than one-third of 1% of that refuge.
Shattuck spoke at this week's Juneau Chamber of Commerce luncheon. The SAFE group plans to ask the CBJ Assembly on July 19th to place the sales tax extension on the October ballot. Mayor Bruce Botello says a North Douglas crossing remains at the top of the city's transportation wish list, but the Assembly will have to hear more before putting a tax measure to voters.
I'm sure that we'd be willing to discuss it. I think the question is on timing, whether this is a subject that is appropriate to be raising this early in terms of trying to put a measure on the ballot.
Botello says another issue that needs to be addressed is what other projects would get a piece of the temporary sales tax revenue.
Whether we're talking street improvements, whether we're talking sewer and water extension, whether we're talking other facilities, they come to the fore at the point that the Assembly is being asked to look at an extension.
Almost everyone agrees the project is unlikely to receive state and federal support. Botello says the economy is partially to blame. The crossing is also viewed as a local transportation issue by lawmakers outside Alaska and Juneau. But SAFE member George Elgee says the city has time and time again come through on projects like this.
Just about everything in this town is funded by us. So if we want this project, we're going to have to step up and put our money down and make it happen.
The SAFE group is currently collecting signatures to show the Assembly that there's community support for the project. A survey 4 years ago showed more than three-quarters of Juneau residents support or strongly support a North Douglas crossing. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
This summer, as part of an ongoing project to document and preserve wilderness, the U.S. Forest Service is sending staff, scientists, and volunteers into the field to collect data. KCAW's Lily Mihalik accompanied one such crew into the West Chickagaw Yacobi Wilderness.
For a long time, wilderness was thought of as an area that's not managed. This is wilderness. We leave this wild and leave it be, and it's not a place that we manage. But increasingly, over the last 10 to 20 years, the Forest Service has seen, yes, there is management that's needed in the wilderness, but instead of it being an active management, it's more of a stewardship.
That's Andrew Tomes, Executive Director of the Sitka Conservation Society, or SCS. He says nowadays there's an increasing demand for wilderness experiences, making these surveys especially important.
How do we make sure that, one, we don't love this place to death, and two, how do we understand what's going on in these ecosystems and monitoring the changes that happen here over time?
I've just landed in wilderness. I'm standing here on the banks of Rust Lake in the West Chichikov Yacobi Wilderness. It's overcast, and the only real sound there is the sound of my crew and the sound of the wind. Our team is small, two botanists, one wilderness solitude surveyor, and a member of the Forest Service. Five tiny dots in the middle of 265,000 acres of raw Alaskan wilderness. We're hiking what should be 7 miles or so from Rust Lake to Patterson Bay, documenting signs of human impact and any invasive or sensitive plants along the way. But because wilderness has no road signs, we get a little turned around and take 11 long, wet hours before finally setting up camp to wait for our float plane on the edge of a grizzly-infested estuary. Adam Andis is the wilderness intern for SCS, who has the job of Wilderness Solitude Surveyor. Our first afternoon in the field, he leads me across a marshy maze of streams and explains how to quantify solitude. He's got a checklist.
Everything from jetliners to renegade cabins to footprints, really, I suppose. We'd like to find a baseline to see how much use this place really has. At this point, we're not really sure. Could be just a couple dozen people that visit these areas in a year, and there could be lots more. So I guess in the end, we're really just looking for zeros.
Scott Harris is also with SCS and helps to oversee wilderness surveys in southeast Alaska.
The key thing what we're doing is collecting baseline information. A lot of these areas we're visiting in the field have been poorly studied.
Wilderness, he says, not only allows for solitude, but can also be used as a barometer for change, a way to measure wilderness areas against managed or more developed land. Jay Jensen is the U.S. Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment, with over 193 million visitors each year to the entire park system. He says keeping wilderness pristine isn't as easy as you'd think.
Wilderness areas are meant to be the more untrammeled parts of that system, but with that kind of usage, you can imagine that it becomes a little bit harder and harder to actually maintain that untrammeled character and nature.
Because of this delicate balance, Jensen says wilderness can no longer go un- or undermanaged.
It is really kind of an interesting, I wouldn't say conundrum, but a juxtaposition of these are areas meant to be untouched and untrammeled, but they do take some caretaking. It's not about just drawing a line on a map and calling it good.
Back in the West Chichikov Yacobi Wilderness, I'm starting to get the idea that there's a lot to think about when it comes to wilderness management. But honestly, right now I'm thinking more about grizzly bears, Devil's Club, and a dry place to camp tonight. Reporting in the wilderness of southeast Alaska, this is Lily Mihalik.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
As the sockeye salmon runs in Bristol Bay hit their peak this summer, a group of chefs arrived to cook a few of them. They went to the east side and got a chance to see the Leader Creek processing plant as well as Katmai National Park. The tour was sponsored by Trout Unlimited as part of a campaign against upstream mining in the area where some of the bay's rivers originate. Adam Kane of member station KDLG got a chance to watch the chefs at work and brought back this report.
The chefs took the opportunity to give something back in the way that they know best, by cooking a meal. The main focus of the four-course meal was exactly what the chefs had come to study, Bristol Bay wild-caught salmon. In a kitchen full of top chefs, the sights, sounds, and of course the smells were spectacular. Chef Lisa Schroeder talked about why she always uses wild salmon at her two restaurants in Oregon.
Even if there wasn't a difference, there's 100 reasons to eat wild versus farm-raised. But besides all that, wild salmon just tastes better. There's no doubt about it. Put them side by side. One has flavor and is delicious, and the other one kind of tastes chemically.
Before heading up north, some of the chefs researched which foods were produced in Alaska, as Helene Keenan with Bon Appetit Management explained.
So we're going to glaze the salmon, the sockeye, with birch syrup, and probably a little bit of local honey and mustard, and glaze the sockeye, sear it, finish it in the oven real quick, and then do a take on like an Alaskan salmon niçoise.
In Alaska, following in line with the national mission of Trout Unlimited, the organization is putting a lot of resources towards protecting freshwater fish and habitats against the perceived threat of large-scale resource extraction proposed for the Bristol Bay watershed. Paula Dobbin is the communications director for Trout Unlimited, and she says that the reason for the trip was because chefs and restaurant owners play a big part in the movement to protect Bristol Bay from mining and resource development.
This is part of our Savor Bristol Bay, Vote With Your Fork aspect of our campaign.
At around 7 o'clock that night, sounds from the kitchen began to die down, and roughly 30 people from Bristol Bay and beyond made their way into the lodge to sample the expertly prepared dishes, which included an appetizer of smoked salmon with baked salmon mixed into freshly churned butter, onions, and garlic, and then spread onto toasted bread. The chef in charge of the appetizers was Quentin Topping. He's the executive chef for Google. He incorporates sustainably caught seafood onto the menu for the restaurant at the Silicon Valley tech giant. Dinner consisted of salmon mousse soup, and glazed salmon salad with pickled rhubarb, and king salmon with honey red onion compote on top of mashed red potatoes covered with port sauce. Dessert was made by Chef Joel Chanet from Mill Bay Coffee and Pastries in Kodiak. He made a cake and chocolate balls infused with salmon berry juice. The one ingredient that tied the entire dinner together, the local salmon, was what really made the meal. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
St. Innocent's Academy in Kodiak is an alternative school for youth, which is rooted in the Bulgarian Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition. The study and performance of music is an essential part of the school's curriculum. Recently, the students stopped by the KMXT studio to perform a live radio concert between shows. When he wasn't playing the penny whistle, Academy Director Father Pasius talked about the connection between education, art, and faith.
We start with a Scottish tune. Flowers of Edinburgh, 1, 2, 3. Very, very simply and basically, the arts and all of the arts, music and every one of them, go directly to the soul. They bypass all of the falderal, all of the philosophy and sophistry and other things. It just goes directly. Plato understood this. The early philosophers understood the power of music. And so when it's done in a way that is to instruct, to edify, to encourage, you can give a lecture of thousands of words and weeks of time in just a few songs, and especially if you're participating in them. So it starts to knock on the door of the inner life.
Thank you.
violinists. We have David Young, Mike Hunter, Presbytero Lucia on violin. Sarah Young is on the... Sarah Gonopolsky is on the piano. Sorry, everybody's getting married lately. And we have Ansgar Hoyle on guitar. We've got John Work, who's leaving for 2 months, on bass. So we're going to be missing our bass player for a while. I think that covers our instruments, and probably, and then a series of vocalists, thousands, are here to sing today. You name it, and we'll learn it. So, yes, we really try to span a lot because that folk music is so precious. The culture, the work that each culture did and to preserve their integrity is something that we enjoy studying and then taking up with the music as well. Everything from Hebrew to Arabic to Celtic to Georgian to Italian, of course, to German to Swedish. I mean, the broad range is really expressed in the curriculum and in our extracurricular activities. So we have to keep things broad, and at the same time, we're Christian, we're fundamental Christian, we're Orthodox. And so that practice in itself says, yes, these people are very serious and their practice is very serious. And I know that can be viewed as narrow. And oddly enough, Jesus Christ will say the way is narrow and so forth. And so that will come across too. So it's a mix, goes back and forth, but we try to keep the perspective broad and the discipline narrow.
And that was a performance of some of the students and faculty of the St. Innocent's Academy. The story was produced by KMXT's Diana Gish. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco and Lily Mihalik in Sitka, Dave Croft in Dawson City, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Adam Kane in Dillingham, and Diana Gish in Kodiak. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.